Case number 20-1591, Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press and Associated Press Appellants versus Federal Bureau of Investigation and United States Department of Justice. Ms. Townsend for the appellant, Mr. Busa for the appellees.
Ms. Townsend.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. As you know, there are two issues presented in this appeal. First, whether the FBI has met its burden to demonstrate that the records it has withheld in whole or in part pursuant to Exemption 5 fall within the scope of the deliberative process privilege. And second, whether the FBI has met its burden to demonstrate that it is reasonably foreseeable that harm to an interest the deliberative process privilege is intended to protect would result from disclosure of that material. Because the district court's grant of summary judgment to defendants should be reversed on either ground, I'll start, Your Honors, by addressing the second issue, and I'll come back to the first during the course of my argument. Contrary to defendants' arguments, the foreseeable harm provision that Congress added to FOIA in 2016 made a consequential, meaningful change to the act. Now, under FOIA's plain language, where disclosure is not prohibited by law, agencies are required to disclose records under FOIA, even if they fall within the scope of an exemption, unless the agency can demonstrate that it reasonably foresees that disclosure would harm an interest protected by an exemption. That means in the litigation context, an agency must demonstrate in a manner sufficient for the court to conduct a NOVA review, not only that Exemption 5 applies, but that it's reasonably foreseeable that disclosure of the specific exempt material that the agency seeks to withhold would harm an interest that Exemption 5 is intended to protect.
Ms. Townsend, let me ask some questions about what you just said. In the court's Machado opinion, it describes a government affidavit on a FOIA request. And the affidavit says that disclosure would discourage attorneys from candidly discussing their ideas, strategies, and recommendations, thus impairing the forthright internal discussions necessary for efficient and proper adjudication of administrative appeals. And that was enough. So applying that standard to the facts of our case, what more do you think the government needed to do here that it didn't do here?
And I think, Your Honor, that Judge Katsas's opinion in Machado Amadas, it's distinguishable. It's very instructive in the way that it's distinguishable. At issue in that case was one type of record. Here we're dealing with multiple different types of records, including,
Let me pause there, because that is part of my question, is whatever the government needs to do for Category 1 in our case, if that same explanation applies to categories 2 through 6, is it okay for the government to repeat its exact words and simply copy and paste what was good enough for category 1 and then say for category 2 the same thing, and for 3 and then 4 and then 6?
So let me answer that. I have 2 points to make in response to that, Your Honor. First, I think, And I'm not trying to dodge the question, but I will say it depends on the nature of the specific documents at issue.
That's actually helpful, though. Can we just make sure I'm clear on it? So there are occasions where that would be enough.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about Machado Amadas, because I think it's helpful to exactly this point, because
Can you just help me with the clarification? I'm trying to understand what you answered before. That there are occasions where it would be enough to copy and paste.
I think it's not a question of copying and pasting. It's a question of whether or not the harm that's being identified by the government is tied specifically to the types of records at issue. So if you have records that are very similar, sure, you could cite the same harm, but you have to tie that harm and actually explain how the harm to be protected by the deliberative process privilege, which is the quality of agency decision-making, how that applies in that given context. And that's not what we saw here. And I would point, Your Honors, to the Waller Declaration, for example. There's one paragraph, that's paragraph 20.
Sorry, can I just back up for a second?
Of course, Your Honor.
So the copy and paste thing is maybe not the best language for this foreseeable harm exception, because I just want to make sure I understand what your answer is. And that my understanding is that they're required to make a particularized judgment. Now the harm, the ultimate harm, when they make that judgment and they particularize it to a document or a group of the same category of documents, as long as they've made that particularized judgment, and the harm is laid out in detail to the deliberative process privilege, then they may not have, it could end up being the same words, but they can't just cut and paste. They've got to make the individualized judgment each time. And as it happens for the same, for some types of privileges, the type of harm is likely to have be described in similar words. Words, is that what you were saying?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I apologize if I wasn't clear in responding to Judge Walker's question.
My listening was not clear today.
It is a particularized showing tied to the specific nature, the specific records that the agency is withholding. And yes, there are only a few purposes that this court has identified that are served by the deliberative process privilege. So of course the agency is going to be referring to those specific purposes, I think, with respect to different kinds of documents. But what it can't do, and I think what it has done here, is name all the purposes that the deliberative process privilege is may serve, protecting the candid nature of a subordinate's communications to a senior decision maker, for example, confusion to the public. All of those that have been applied by this court in different circumstances and say, these are all the purposes that the privilege serves, and we're gonna withhold all of these different kinds of documents because one or more of those purposes may be undermined if we disclose one or more of these documents. And I think if you look at the materials that were released mid-appeal by the government in this case, after our opening brief was filed, you can see examples where this just completely breaks down. And I was pointing to the provision in the Waller Declaration, paragraph 20, which is really this umbrella paragraph that really speaks in very general terms about the purported harm that would flow from disclosure. And so I'll jump to the middle of that paragraph, but it effectively says, to require disclosure of the withheld information would prevent OIG from engaging in meaningful, documented discussion about policy matters in the future, which could have a negative effect on agency decision-making and would potentially confuse the public about the reasons for the OIG's adoption, for the OIG's actions, excuse me, in this matter. It would also reveal the thought and decision-making processes of the OIG and may not reflect the agency's decisions. So that rationale was proffered by OIG with respect to multiple different types of documents, including documents we now know, if you look at Joint Appendix 494, which is one of the documents that was withheld in part previously, released in full during the course of this appeal, the agency proffered that rationale to withhold a single sentence, completely factual in nature, about that indicated that the OIG had provided a draft report to the FBI at one point. And so I think this is why there were, and I think at this stage, we would say there's nothing deliberative, there's certainly nothing pre-decisional about that document. That's the memoranda that was attached to the final OIG report. There's certainly nothing deliberative about it. And the notion that any harm to the agency's, the quality of the agency decision-making process, which again, is what the deliberative process privilege is designed to protect, is untenable. Any argument on the part of the government would be untenable. And I think that's why they released it mid-appeal, but I also think it illustrates the fundamental lack of sufficiency of the agency showing on appeal. And just to point, I'm sorry, go ahead, Your Honor, Judge Katsas.
Isn't it fair to think that the robustness of the necessary explanation on foreseeable harm would depend on the category, would depend on the sensitivity of the documents we're talking about, right? If someone makes a FOIA request for the nuclear launch codes, you wouldn't need a really long explanation on foreseeable harm, right? So that principle helps you on many of these categories, but let me press you on one that seems to me a harder one for you, which is the Comey emails. You know from context that the agency has this problem on its hands. It's significant enough that the director of the agency feels like he has to write to the New York Times, which doesn't really happen every day. sensitive subject matter, PR debacle. I mean, isn't it pretty obvious from the context that deliberations with regard to that kind of document implicate the interests of the privilege and their release would harm the interests that the privilege protects?
I would say no, Your Honor. I think not all discussions are deliberative. Sometimes decisions are made without deliberation. And I think that's one of the reasons why this court's case law indicates that you look to where in the chain of command the communications are coming from and where they're going. And when we're talking about former Director Comey's communications to people who worked for him, we don't know what those communications say because they've been redacted, but it's very reasonable to think on the face of those documents, and particularly without any additional showing, that what former Director Comey is doing is explaining a decision he's made or directing someone who's a subordinate to him to carry out his instructions. And so I think that that's why the deliberative application of the deliberative process privilege itself is very fact specific. And as you noted, Judge Katsas, I think it's correct to say that the showing that the agency makes with respect to the application of the deliberative process privilege is also interrelated with the foreseeable harm analysis.
Right. I thought it was pretty clear. I'll go back and look at the documents, but I thought it was pretty clear that he was providing comments on a draft letter.
I think there are, it may be clear to you, Your Honor, was not clear to us. It appears that he is providing information or direction, again, that's redacted in redacted form to subordinates, which again is relevant. And I think it also goes to the foreseeable harm question, because even if the document is deliberative, even if it's
something, is that inconsistent if Mr. Comey is providing comments on a draft letter, and you're saying, well, it looks like he was providing directions to a subordinate, but if the directions are make these edits to the draft letter, you're both the same in the description, but the one seems more squarely within the deliberative process privilege, right? If the directions are, let's make these changes before we announce this position, that would definitely still be protected.
I would think, Your Honor, that it depends on the context, but it could be that the decision is already made and that former Director Comey is just instructing his subordinate on what the decision is he has made. And again, because that information is redacted, that's not clear. But again, I would agree in principle.
Sorry, go ahead. Finish, please. I
would agree in principle that there are certain types of material, and this court has recognized this in coastal states, for example, that there's the classic case of the deliberative process at work. And that is a subordinate attorney, for example, providing advice. And I think this flows into Judge Katsas's decision in Machado Amadis. I think it's very consistent. There are certain types of decisions, line attorneys, commentary to their senior attorneys, or providing legal advice on specific matters, that's at the core of the deliberative process privilege. And perhaps the foreseeable harm showing is different or less rigorous than it must be for a situation where the records at issue are not the kind of decision that the deliberative or decision-making process that the deliberative process privilege is really geared towards. What does our PowerPoint presentation, how should it be organized when all it does is repeat existing policy? And that is certainly what we've seen from the slides that were released at Joint Appendix 500 through 513 mid-appeal. Publicly available information, how are we going to organize that for a PowerPoint presentation? That's not the kind of decision that the deliberative process privilege is geared towards protecting. And the notion that the agency has to do more to demonstrate that harm will flow from disclosure of that information, I think is common sense, quite frankly, but I think it's also consistent with this court's decisions, as well as the way that the foreseeable harm provision has been applied, not only in Machado Amadis by this court, but by the district courts as well. I see that I've run into my rebuttal time.
Don't worry about that. Can I ask you a question on the comments or the documents as the communications as they're developing this editorial? how do you distinguish the Krikorian case?
I think that there's no case law that indicates that that media strategy in and of itself, sort of quote unquote media strategy documents in and of themselves, are necessarily, just by virtue of being media strategy, are exempt from disclosure under the deliberative process privilege. And I think if we look back at the pre-foreseeable harm cases, like Coastal States and other cases that look at the, that focus on, that don't collapse the distinction between pre-decisional and deliberative, you can see that. And I do think that there is a strong distinction. I think it is an important factor that with respect to these documents, it is not a subordinate providing commentary, at least as far as we can tell, providing their independent candid advice to Director Comey about whether or not he should write a letter to the editor of the New York Times. It is Director Comey telling his subordinates the decision that he has made. And so the harm of discouraging subordinates from providing candid advice to their superiors to aid in policymaking or decision-making, it's just not implicated there. And so I do think it is different, and it has to be looked at a case-by-case basis.
So you make a fair point, and I have Machado very much in the back of my mind. You make a fair point that it could be different when the deliberation is running from the superior to the subordinate rather than vice versa. But even so, I mean, you could imagine a lot of circumstances where the component head is trying to figure out what to do. And of course, he has the final decision-making authority, but he wants to bounce ideas off of people. You could also imagine a situation where he has made the decision to take the strongest case for you, and he says, take out the sentence that says X. And it turns out X is a really dumb idea, and it, you know, would be embarrassing if that proposal were disclosed. I mean, it just doesn't seem all that different to me, this kind of thing, from the Category 1 documents from what we had in Machado.
Well, what I'll say, Your Honor, is that we're not taking any kind of categorical position, actually, as to concerning whether or not there are specific types of documents that that absolutely cannot be protected, subject either to the deliberative process privilege or that meet the foreseeable harm provision. Well, our position is the agency hasn't made that showing here. And I think if all, and that they would be required to, and perhaps they could on remand.
I understand, but I'm just, you know, Judge Walker opened by saying that the agency declaration in Machado was relatively short, but part of the reason for that might be that the sensitivity of those documents was pretty apparent, and maybe the sensitivity of the Comey comments is similar in degree. That's all I'm saying.
I warn Your Honor that I think that the court's conclusion in Machado Amadas, and I think this, at least to my eye, is evident from the opinion itself, is that it was a certain specific type of document. So they're not multiple types of documents, and they were what the court, what was consistent with what the court has found to be really at the core of the classic case core deliberative process material, which may require not the same kind of showing that other material, including some of the material we're talking about here, would require.
Okay, thanks.
My colleagues have any further questions? Ms. Townsend, we'll give you a couple minutes on rebuttal. So is it Busa or Busa? I apologize.
Busa, Your Honor. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Joe Busa on behalf of the federal government appellees. I'd like to start with what's occupied most of the discussion this morning, which is the second question presented here, and the requirement the agency reasonably foresee that harm would result from disclosure. And this requirement requires the agency to consider the specific information at issue in the case, Machado makes that clear, and then to link that conclusion to the interest protected by any given FOIA exemption. It doesn't narrow the types of interests protected by the FOIA exemption, nor does it raise the degree of harm required before the agency can withhold the information. It takes...
I want to push a little bit on. It struck me a little bit odd that treat it like, you know, you apply the FOIA exemptions, go through all that, and then we go apply this foreseeable harm thing when apart from the parts to which foreseeable harm does not apply, so say exemptions 1 and 3 generally foreclosed by law. It seems to me what the foreseeable harm provision did was put into every other exemption an additional prong, right? Because you have to apply it to every exemption decision. So we should now understand the deliberative process privilege to have its usual elements, plus you must make this particularized document or document category judgment. And as we said in Machado, that the information would cause the harm protected by that privilege. And we know from FOIA that the difference between would and could is actually material between exemptions 6 and 7C, for example. It's a higher standard to show that a harm would happen than that it could happen. And it seems to me that in fact, there is that to that degree an adjustment in how deliberative process is looked at. It's not enough now to say, we do this stuff sort of deliberately in advance, and it could be bad if we disclose it, because it could chill people. That you actually need to say that the nature of this document, the nature of this particular deliberative process in this circumstance would. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor, we agree with that outline here, but just to highlight a few things that flow from that. The first is that the agency is making a predictive judgment about the effects of disclosure here on future similar deliberative processes. That's not readily susceptible to documentary evidence. It's hard to see what the agency could do to prove that judgment, either true or false. And the court's not called upon to make its own judgment here. It's called upon to determine whether the agency's judgment is within a broad zone of reasonable judgments that it's capable of making on the basis of the deliberative interests at stake here. And secondly,
I'm sorry. Where do we have any assurance in the declarations here that the government took this task seriously? You know, and it didn't, I think you didn't have Machado at the time of the declarations. Because all I see is a sort of general language about, here's all these different types of documents. And they all were part of a deliberative process. And so there'll be foreseeable harm. And it seems to me if we say that's sufficient in this case, then the foreseeable harm function will do no work, at least in the deliberative process realm. Because all you're gonna do is say, remember when we told you about deliberative process? Yeah. Cut and paste, as Judge Walker said.
Your Honor, I don't think, so first I wanna go through.
That individualized sort of document category of, you've got more than one in the same category document, and it would cause harm, not just the nature of deliberative process. Always, the argument is always that it chills. I need more here. And when you look at Machado, where the explanation of how the process, what the process is, how it worked, how the input was, how it was used, what the nature of these blitz forms were, went on for like 4 or 5 pages in the declaration. Where do you have anything remotely like that? Which declaration?
Well, first, what we've got in the third Hardy Declaration, I'm at pages 248 to 249 of the Joint Appendix. This is where the declarant begins the whole section on deliberative process privilege by saying, look, encoded categories B5-1 in the Vaughan Index, that's all the 99 records that are at issue here. The FBI protected privileged deliberative materials. Then goes on for, I believe, 3 or 4 sentences to discuss the general purposes behind the deliberative process privilege. That's not to chill candid conversations in order to improve the quality of agency decision making. And then the key sentences are, disclosure of this type of information would have an inhibiting effect on agency decision making because it would chill full and frank discussions. That's a conclusion as to each of the next. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Were these paragraphs written before the OIG report cover letter was disclosed or after?
Well, we disclosed almost all of the OIG cover report in advance of the preparation of this declaration, I believe.
While the case has been pending, I think on appeal.
Right? Correct, Your Honor.
Okay,
correct.
So these statements here, though, which are obviously made before your disclosure on appeal, would have then been defending this OIG cover letter. It was a determination. Your argument seems to be that there was a determination in these paragraphs you're pointing to here. The disclosure of the OIG cover letter specifically, looking at that document, would cause foreseeable harm. Is that right?
At the time they were written, yes, Your Honor. And that's because that sentence.
Okay. Now, I know you've released it, but explain to me how on earth I can trust that this information makes that particularized judgment when it turns out. And this is probably why you released it on appeal. It turns out that what was redacted was these words. This is one example that you have since released. OIG report entitled A Review of the FBI's Use of a Fictitious Associated Press News Article in a Criminal Investigation. That same language had already been revealed in the Vaughn Index. So how can I trust? Just tell me what foreseeable harm would come from revealing information you'd over a statement, a description of a document you'd already revealed in Vaughn Index?
Your Honor, we disclosed that because we determined, yes, there had been a mistake as to.
On appeal.
Yes, Your Honor.
I know,
yes.
But my question is very different. You're relying on the Hardy Declaration as having made the Machado foreseeable harm judgment to retain and not disclose that very language I just quoted to you. Is that correct? That's what this Hardy language decided?
That's correct, Your Honor. And our basic point here is.
You made a disclosure on appeal. Do you agree then? Can we credit this Hardy declaration with having made any kind of particularized or careful judgment when it didn't stop to notice that what it was claiming as foreseeable harm included a mere description of a document that had already publicly disclosed?
Yes, Your Honor, because I'm not aware of any case from this court or other courts saying that one error, an unintentional error in an affidavit, means that the court cannot rely on any other portion of that.
We had a second one, and that was another redaction you've released, where again, the language is just the description of the document. Right, the second one you released. The Office of the Inspector General has completed its report entitled A Review of the FBI's Impersonation of a Journalist in a Criminal Investigation. In August 2016, we provided a copy of the draft report to the FBI for comment, including whether anything in the draft report was factually inaccurate or too sensitive for public release. That was all already known at the time you're telling me Mr. Hardy said, we cannot possibly release that because it would cause not just general deliberate process harm, but making a particularized judgment that would cause foreseeable harm.
That's correct, Your Honor. This case involves over six. Your Honor.
You got two times now where this very generalized language protected, supposedly made a foreseeable harm judgment as to something that was already publicly disclosed by the government.
Your Honor, this case involved over 600 pages of responsible records.
Right. I'm just asking you to confirm that.
Yes, I believe those were mistakes, Your Honor.
I get that there were a lot of documents here, but the question is whether that second look, let's call it foreseeable harm, a second look and a particularized judgment that harm not could, but would occur. And there may be a lot of documents, but even I think the foreseeable harm requirement applies in cases when there's lots of documents, right?
Of course, Your Honor, but there's flexibility in how.
There may be some flexibility, but does it require that there at least be, it wasn't like there were tons, and this is the OIG cover letter. It's not like there were 12,000 OIG cover letters that you were having to group together as a category. This was a category of one, the OIG cover letter. Did you have to make a foreseeable harm judgment as to the OIG cover letter?
Your Honor, yes, the declarant has to make a determination as to every category of records, not just with respect to...
It was a category of one.
Yes, every category is separate in this case, but there are six categories of records just within the deliberative process privilege. There are other exemption five arguments as well for lots of other records, not in this appeal. There were over 600 responsive records. I believe there were six different FOIA exemptions invoked, and there were withholdings, and I believe over...
What is the relevance of all this to the foreseeable harm argument that this sort of very generalized paragraph, the paragraphs you said on sort of 248, 249, extremely generalized and high level, met the sort of individualized and careful second look judgment that foreseeable harm requires in a Machado?
You're right, it's not just these two paragraphs. I mean, to be clear, I was not able to finish my answer. So there's the paragraph we were just discussing. There's the first sentence on the next page saying the FBI invokes exemption five in this case because FBI employees would hesitate to offer their candid advice. And then, this is crucial, the descriptions of the deliberative processes within each of the six categories and the roles that those records play in those deliberative processes serves two functions. It goes both to the applicability of the deliberative process privilege, and it also goes to why the agency's reasonable harm determination was reasonable in this case. Machado shows us the way. Machado says that the agency's prediction of foreseeable harm in that case was reasonable on the basis of that the agency's conclusion that release of that information would chill future deliberations. And that is clearly true in, say, category six in this case.
The declaration there that we know at least twice was just false in making that judgment.
Your Honor, in a large FOIA case, there can be errors. And so, for instance, a district court can look at a very long declaration, uphold most of the withholdings.
Is this a mistake that they had? Can you articulate to me what, if they looked at the OIG report cover memo at all, if they picked it up and looked at it, is your position that someone could have looked at that, the language that was redacted, and decided that there would be foreseeable harm from disclosing that information?
Or that if that information had not previously been disclosed, and if the declarant knows that.
It had already been previously disclosed. That's exactly my point. I'm not
right. And so my understanding.
When they, to make foreseeable harm under your theory, they had to look at it, that they could have made it and it was a reasonable mistake, or did they maybe not look at it?
My point is that it was a reasonable mistake that, you know, at the time the declaration was put together, the declarant, you know, did not put two and two together with respect to the fact that that sentence, that this draft had already been shared with the FBI, had already been disclosed elsewhere in this litigation. That's why we voluntarily disclosed it on appeal, and that's why that issue is moot.
Without having already been disclosed, can you just describe to me what the foreseeable harm would be if it hadn't already been disclosed, what the foreseeable harm of those two sentences is?
My understanding is the foreseeable harm would be to open up the hood on the deliberative process and disclose to the world that OIG circulated a draft before publication. Now, I don't want to go too far down the road and saying that is the biggest harm on the planet.
Is it a secret that, that's not what I asked you. Is it a secret that OIG circulates to involved agencies a report before releasing it?
I don't think in general that's a secret, Your Honor. I'm not aware of, you know, to what degree every time they circulate, it's a secret. To every time they prepare a report, they share it with the agency in advance, or to what extent in certain circumstances they don't. But just to focus on, you know, the six categories at issue here, I think it is beyond clear that internal deliberations about media strategy, whether and when to engage with the media and write a press release, you know, are within the core of the deliberative process privileges. Every court of appeals to address that issue has held. Similarly, with the category six, you know, we have emails saying, look, these are the current policies, recommendation. This is what we should or shouldn't do with these policies. We black out the recommendation. That's again, within the core of what the privilege protects. And it is beyond reasonable for the agency.
I'd like to ask you about these PowerPoint presentations.
Yes, Your Honor.
First of all, so one's been released, but there were two more that were not. Are those Are those two drafts of the presentation that was released?
Yes, Your Honor.
They are drafts. Okay, that was released. And in the Vaughn index, the Vaughn index described the final presentation as draft slides. But then when they're released, Mr. Gavin's email says that the attached slides were as briefed to the White House. So does that mean that the released one was actually the final?
Yes, Your Honor. That's why we released it.
That's why it was released. Okay. And then I noticed that the Mr. Hardy's declaration said that the slides were about, sorry, I think it was Mr. Hardy, maybe it was Mr. Waller, described those slides very differently, not about a presentation of existing policy to the White House, but as proposals and recommendations about how to ultimately instruct FBI personnel about conducting undercover operations, which sounds like something might fall within the deliberative process. But I noticed that you have not relied on that description of these documents, nor on that rationale in invoking deliberative process privilege. Is that because there was a mistake?
No, Your Honor. So it is accurate that those drafts and the final presentation were prepared with the idea that they might be used to instruct FBI personnel. As the released email shows, they were also used in this presentation at the White House.
Okay, so the White House was a presentation about existing policy. Correct,
Your Honor. This presentation is a presentation. I'm sorry?
A demonstration or an explanation about existing policy is what certainly the final was about. And you're saying that instead the draft was about proposals and recommendations on instructing FBI personnel about conducting undercover operations. The draft was not about, these drafts were not about explaining existing policy to the White House.
No, Your Honor, I think those two sentences are saying the same thing.
Ooh, those. If I say I'm describing existing, certainly for deliberative process, if I'm describing existing policy, one agency describes existing policy to another agency because it's the White House, but to another governmental entity, that means you're describing the final policy, the existing policy. But then this Hardy declaration, which I didn't see discussed in your brief, talks about proposals and recommendations on how to conduct, undercover operations.
No, Your Honor, it's saying it's
describing an existing policy.
No, these are proposals and recommendations about how to instruct, including FBI personnel, about existing policies. So for example, if the general counsel of an organization says, tasks a subordinate and says, I want a proposal about how to train all of our people about a certain issue, that person goes out and canvasses all potentially applicable policies, arrays them together, and creates a recommendatory memo about how this should happen. That the draft of that memo about how to instruct people in the organization is deliberative and pre-decisional as to any final training documents. And again, we've released the final document at issue here. The key point is the drafts of that document contain deliberative information about how to do that presentation, how to do that instruction. Okay.
And then on the factual accuracy comments, these are just some more that I have some concerns about or questions about. We have that form in the record. Can you point me where in the record, because Judge Leon concluded that the information in there, factual accuracy, is so intrinsically linked to the FBI's personal recommendations and opinions. So it's those facts that are so intrinsically linked with recommendations that they fall within the deliberative process privilege outside the general rule that facts don't. And which declaration said that they were intrinsically linked?
That's the third Hardy Declaration, page 251 of the Joint Appendix, where the declarant says the FBI concluded that the factual information in the responsive records here was part of the deliberation itself and inextricably intertwined with deliberative information, and therefore.
Sorry, I just want to catch up to you. Which page and which paragraph?
Page 251 of the Joint Appendix. I'm sorry, Your Honor. So that's the specific sentence.
Uh-huh.
And I think this dovetails with something this court said in the National Security Archives case, which is that when it comes to an agency history, a draft agency history, yes, there's going to be lots of factual information all throughout that description, but the selection of those facts, the characterization of those facts, the choice of which ones are relevant, all are chosen based on a policy-inflected judgment of the writer or the editor. Here, what we've got are comments about basically the same type of document.
I just need to back you up. You're talking about paragraph 55 on page 251?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and so what it says is the FBI concluded that the factual information in the responsive records here was part of the deliberation itself and inextricably intertwined with deliberative information. All he's doing is describing what the FBI asserted. That's what we have to rely on.
Well, this is the FBI's declaration, Your Honor. So declarant is saying.
I'm not saying it's his view. He's just sort of, what he actually there is describing the bottom line position. Is that sufficient?
Your Honor, I would read this as the declarant saying that it is true. And I don't think there should be a magic words requirement in that level of parsing.
Requirements, because all I should think you'd want magic words because they've done the magic words here and said they're inextricably intertwined, but we're given no explanation whatsoever. It sounds like instead they just sort of said, here's what we have to say to keep it out. And so—
Your Honor, I'm sorry to interrupt. I didn't mean to.
No, please go ahead.
So I think back to what this court has said about the segregability requirement in FOIA, and very commonly in declarations like this one, including this one, there will just be a paragraph or a sentence saying, I have considered this. And, you know, the information we have withheld is not reasonably segregable from the rest of it. It doesn't require the repetition of that conclusion. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We're missing the I. Mr. Hardy's not saying it. He's just describing the FBI's position.
Your Honor, on it.
FBI, but is this, usually the declarant says, I've looked at them and I've concluded they're inextricably intertwined. But, so that's why I'm confused.
Your Honor, actually, I think most commonly they just say the information is inextricably intertwined. Here, I would most reasonably read the FBI concluded that phrase, as the declarant saying I concluded that, given that he's offering this declaration on behalf of the agency to explain why the withholdings are proper.
Okay, sorry.
And just in the segregability point, I think it really is important. It's an important pre-existing requirement of the FOIA. Information that we withhold has to be not be able to be reasonably segregated from other disclosable information. But the court has always accepted even a single paragraph or sentence saying, yes, this information is, the remaining information is not reasonably segregable from the rest. For the same reason, the conclusion about, I consider the information at issue in this case and release of that information would result in harm to the interests protected by the deliberative process privilege, that should be enough, especially in a case here where there's so many different types of documents, so many different types of withholdings. It would needlessly expend government resources to just repeat the same sentence at the end of each paragraph about each specific deliberative process, especially when the government's already explained the nature of the deliberative processes going on and the role of those records sufficiently to trigger the protections of the privilege. That same information shows why the government's determination about harm is reasonable, again, within that broad zone of reasonableness. That's a predictive judgment not readily susceptible to documentary proof.
Okay. Go ahead, Judge Kett. I'm gonna see if you have more questions.
I have to say what strikes me about the overall case is there are the different categories of documents are very different from one another. And your arguments on some of them seem to me intuitively or superficially much stronger than your arguments as to others. And I mean, you know, I pressed your colleague about the Comey comments, which seemed to me a relatively strong part of the case for you, and you went right to category one, but we also have category two, category three seem to me a lot weaker for you. And I mean, if you're just gonna, you know, we're talking about a category defined as factual accuracy measured against a legal rule that statements of fact are generally unprotected unless you show they're inextricably bound up with deliberations. And your affidavit just has a boilerplate assertion, this is all bound up in deliberations, boom, we're done, that's it. That's giving us very little to work with doing our review for reasonableness. And it seems to me very different from Machado, where they did say more as to the particular category at issue, and the particular category at issue was much closer to the heartland rather than the periphery of an exemption.
Your Honor, on categories 2 and 3, I think this court's case law regarding draft agency histories is very instructive. Again, a draft agency history is going to largely consist of almost entirely factual material. This court said that the factual material there cannot be dissected, quote unquote, from the editorial judgments underlying the preparation of that history. And I think just an analogy to a fact statement in a brief. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That was all before the harm provision was put in, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, but the harm provision, again, doesn't change the type of interest protected or ratchet up the amount of harm required before information can be withheld. It requires a predictive judgment that the harm actually would come about, and that judgment has to be reasonable.
It elevates the standard, as Judge Millett said, to the extent that a would is stronger than could. It seems to require a greater degree of particularization in the explanation, right? You can't just say, histories can be protected, could be protected, and this is a history, QED, right? So.
And to be clear, we have more than that here, right? So the Waller Declaration says, and I want to make this point, my colleague on the other side pointed to paragraph 20, but I would point to paragraphs 14 and 16, that's pages 278 to 279 of the Joint Appendix, which talk more specifically about these drafts, where the declarant, Ms. Waller, says that release of that information would chill the OIG's ability to have candid discussions between the subject of the report and OIG before the finalization of a report.
So just to drill down a little bit on drafts, what would be the reasonably foreseeable harm in releasing a redacted draft which shows everything that made its way into the final report unchained?
Well, Your Honor, it would reveal the degree to which the writer of that draft accurately predicted or did not what the final decision maker is going to want to have out there, right? So it's going to reveal the kind of editorial judgments and suggestions that this court said were protectable, honestly, in the heartland of the deliberative process privilege. You know, the opinions in Russell, Dudman, National Security Archive, they don't read as if this is some kind of questionable application of the privilege. They read as if this is an application to the heartland of that privilege. And I think that's correct. And so, you know, the OIG declaration from Ms. Waller says that, look, release of a draft that's not final shows our preliminary thinking on this subject, and it would chill our ability to have future discussions of this type in the future. That is true. People in that, it's just a matter of common sense and human nature that people, when they're writing a draft, need to have confidence that, you know, it's not going to be released in the future in order to have truly candid conversations and to think and to improve the quality of government decision making. That's the core application of the privilege. It applies to a draft OIG report in the same way that it applies to a draft agency history. Nothing in the legislative history, or certainly the text of the 2016 amendments, says, look, we're really going to be working a revolution in the way the privilege applies. You know, to the contrary, it just says the agency has to reasonably foresee that release would lead to one of the harms, you know, that's protected by the privilege. You know, we've shown why these declarations, you know, pass that minimum threshold. We did that without the benefit of this court's instruction in Machado Amadi. And so if the declarations fall short in any respects as to any particular categories, we do think a remand would be in order. But I've tried to explain why in a sprawling case involving here hundreds, in other cases, thousands of documents and dozens of different types of withholdings in many different categories of information, there's no reason to needlessly expend government resources to repeat the same conclusion in each paragraph.
And I assume you're going to give me basically the same answer on the factual accuracy category, which is there's some instances where factual statements are bound up in deliberations. And even if that seems like more the exception than the rule, it's enough for the agency just to have a one sentence statement that we looked at all the factual accuracy comments and withheld ones that are inextricably intertwined with deliberations.
That's right, Your Honor, but I also want to highlight that that follows from the conclusion as to the draft OIG reports themselves, right? It's because the factual content there is inextricably intertwined, cannot be dissected from policy-based judgment, so too comments on that. It's just like if a senior partner and an associate in a law firm are working on a draft brief and the factual statement in that brief, obviously the factual statements, they're all fact, but they're all chosen with very clear policy-based judgment in mind. Ditto with this court's opinions and the factual sections therein. I don't think anyone can say that, you know, one person's comments on a draft brief circulating in your court, you know, are not deliberative simply because they involve factual material. It's just like the factual material in a draft agency history, and it's protected.
I hear you. It just seems like on that view of the world, the amendment is, as a practical matter, going to do very little work, very little extra work above and beyond the exemption.
I don't think that's true. You know, I don't have a categorical view of exactly how many cases the amendment's going to really make a difference in, but it's primarily a procedural requirement that's going to have an effect on the front end. It requires the agency to actually consider the specific information. And even if in an esoteric case, it could have gotten away with saying, well, the privilege would apply, I'm not actually sure if there'd actually be any harm, that's not going to be good enough anymore. The agency has to, considering that, think, no, it actually would result in that harm. And so you're going to get more upfront disclosures. But there's no indication in the text of the amendment that Congress thought there'd be a revolution in the way that any of the underlying exemptions work. In particular, the legislative history shows, look, they thought they might want to make some changes with regards to this privilege, but they're only able to agree on language as to the 25-year event horizon.
I agree with you on that, but it seems like there's a broad middle ground between a revolution and a here and there screwball case. And I'm not sure this is designed to just get at the screwball cases.
I think Machado says, look, it takes a could and makes it a would. And so on the edges, it's going to have that effect. But that could to would language is about the predictive judgment and the relative likelihood of the harm occurring, not about the nature of the harm or the size of it.
It also focuses the analysis on the documents at issue. I mean, we didn't talk about deliberative process in the abstract. We talked about recommendations by subordinate lawyers to superiors regarding the adjudication of pending appeals.
Right, but to be clear, you know, the Reporters Committee filed amicus brief saying, well, actually that case should come out even in Machado. You know, and Machado disposes of many of the arguments you're facing here. It says, look, this really is about a predictive judgment. It's about broad-based reasonableness. It's not about ratcheting up the type or the amount of harm or the nature of the interests that are protected. And the final thing I want to say about Machado is the sentences there about foreseeable harm all talk about the specific deliberative process at issue because there's only one deliberative process at issue. I think this court has always left flexibility for how an agency makes out its showing about the withholdability under an exemption in a case involving large number of documents, large number of withholdings. And that's appropriate. Taking together the declarations, the Vaughn Index, And the information we've released, on the basis of that entire record, the question is whether the judgment was reasonable, not whether the court would have made the same judgment.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor. We ask that you affirm.
Can I jump in with one question? It'll be short. Can you imagine a time, can you imagine a scenario when release of a draft would not chill? And if so, when?
There's a huge number of factional scenarios in the federal government. It's a big government. There's lots of drafts. And I could imagine that if, say, the FOIA office gets a request and they go to the person, let's say the person who still works there, and they go to that person and they say, what do you think about foreseeable harm here? If the person literally doesn't care and says that, and if in the judgment of the FOIA officer that actually represents
that, no,
everybody in the future.
I know I said only one, but the chill is the future chill. We're worried about chilling future authors of drafts. So it doesn't really matter if the original author is fine with the release.
No, and that's where I was trying to get with the extension of my answer, Your Honor. It's not just does the author care, but it's also, look, is that the view of basically everyone who fulfills this function inside of the federal government? And if in fact it's not going to chill anybody, or if the public interest in making the disclosure outweighs whatever the chill would have been, the government could make a discretionary release, of course. But it's going to be a very fact-based determination using common sense and also the government's experience with what people fulfilling this function need to enhance the quality of our decision-making. And it is true that this court's pre-existing case law about the privilege has already drawn pretty strict boundaries about where it applies. And the basis on which this court drew those boundaries even before foreseeable harm was largely about whether that harm would arise if that type of information were released. That's why the foreseeable harm requirement as applied to the writ of process privilege is not going to work a revolution in what's protectable and what's not, because this court's case law already did quite a bit of that work. All this does is move the could to a would in the context of a predictive judgment. I'm sorry, Judge Millett, I think you might be muted. I apologize for interrupting.
It's my mistake, but I apologize, Judge Walker. Are you done?
I am, thank you.
I'm having lots of technical difficulties today. The government gets gazillions of FOIA requests. Are you aware of any, so you don't have to describe an example, but are you just aware as a practical matter whether any deliberative process, what would have been a deliberative process withholding prior to the foreseeable harm amendment has been revisited and released in the deliberate, I'm really worried about deliberate, focusing particularly on deliberate process here that the government has done, even just within the Justice Department. It's hard for me to ask you to know about every FOIA agency and every FOIA decision in the government.
And I have to apologize, Your Honor. I don't have that kind of panoramic view into our FOIA dockets.
It's a crazy broad question. You don't have to apologize. I was just curious whether any chance your client knew that they had taken a difference.
I don't have that, you know. I just don't want to highlight again the extent to which the privilege was already designed to serve a specific purpose, to prevent the chilling of future deliberations. And this court has been pretty strict about where it applies and where it doesn't apply, even before the foreseeable harm requirement. And so I think that's why it wouldn't actually be surprising if, you know, it has an effect on the margins. It changes the could to the would, but it's not going to work a revolution.
My colleagues have any further questions?
All set.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Busa.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Townsend, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I'll be very brief. I do want to address, with respect to the factual accuracy comments, just to ensure that the record is clear, Mr. Busa pointed to paragraph 55 of the third Hartley Declaration, which is Joint Appendix 251, citing that sentence. The FBI concluded that the factual information in the responsive records here was part of the deliberation itself and inextricably intertwined with deliberative information. Just to be clear, that sentence is purportedly applicable to every single piece of factual information that might have been withheld by the government in all the records. It's not specific to the factual accuracy comments. And I would note that the government has taken the position that the factual accuracy comments, the deliberative process, is actually related to the work of OIG, and the Waller Declaration, which is the OIG Declaration, doesn't speak to the factual accuracy comments at all. So I think just to clarify that, and to go to the segregability point, I also wanted to raise this as well. Segregability is a longstanding requirement of FOIA with respect to exemptions. There's also a separate segregability requirement that Congress enacted as part of the foreseeable harm provision. So not only must agencies segregate non-exempt information from exempt information, they must segregate exempt information that is harmful from exempt information that is not harmful. And I did want to touch very briefly in just the last 30 seconds on this notion of Mr. Busa's continued citation to case law concerning draft agency history with respect to OIG reports. I think as we stated in our briefs, we would respectfully posit that a draft agency history is nothing like a draft OIG report. Inspector generals are independent. They're required by statute to provide oversight to agencies. Agencies are required by statute to provide aid and information to inspectors general. And even the case law that Mr. Busa relies on draws a factual distinction in draft agency histories. Dudman, for example, makes very clear that even if a document is a draft, an agency cannot withhold factual material within that draft. And here, the agencies withheld all of the draft OIG reports. And again, as Judge Katz just noted, that case, Dudman, as well as the National Security Archive case, is not only pre-foreseeable harm provision, but the Bay of Pigs case, the National Security Archive case that Mr. Busa cited, was in fact, as a legislative history indicates, one of the rationales for enacting the foreseeable harm provision, and in particular, the 25-year sunset provision. So if there are no further questions, Your Honor, thank you for your time, and we will respectfully request that it be reversed and remanded.
Any further questions from my colleagues? All right. Thank you both. The case is submitted.